If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Was Shakespeare a snob? His plays are peppered with characters from right across the social spectrum, from kings and nobility down to servants, soldiers and shepherds. But how are those at the bottom of that hierarchy portrayed? Are they, in the words of King Lear, just poor naked wretches? Theatre director and writer Stephen Unwin considers this question in a new book that explores the bard's working characters. And Rhiannon Davis spoke to him to find out how far these figures reflected the reality of living and working in Elizabethan England.
Being a theatre director, what perspective did this offer you when writing about Shakespeare's working people?
The funny thing about this book is I've been writing it on and off for 40 years, literally 40 years since I was a student and I got the kind of idea for it. As a theatre director, and I've directed lots and lots of Shakespeare, but lots of other things as well, you're always trying to understand the full range of life of the characters, of the story, of the drama that you're presenting. And what I think I found is that in the way that Shakespeare was largely regarded, it was about a narrow range of characters, the famous characters, who on the whole were the aristocratic or royal figures. I mean, if you stop somebody in the street and said, give me some Shakespeare characters, they'd say Romeo and Hamlet, and they're always the upper classes. But when you're working in the theatre, you've got a messenger, you've got a soldier, you've got a prostitute, you've got a shepherd, you've got all these other figures. And I think I found myself intrigued by who were they and to what extent was Shakespeare writing about the people who he saw and he knew, and how much respect, if you like, was he giving these figures? And that's part of a broader question which has happened for all kinds of complicated reasons, I think, since the 400 years since Shakespeare wrote these plays, which is the kind of assumption that a playwright, that a genius, will have a sort of contempt for working people. And what really struck me about that, and there's all sorts of notions which happen in literary criticism, in the theatre, in all sorts of assumptions about that contempt. And it just struck me that it was completely ahistorical, incredibly unlikely, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, one of them is that Shakespeare wrote for a popular audience, or certainly for a mixed audience. And so you sort of think, well, if he wrote for such a mixed audience, such a social range, he's not going to insult them by present. You know, he's a commercial playwright. He's trying to make a living. Why would he insult his audience, his popular audience, by saying that they were stupid or hopeless or simply there for comic relief? That's a very long answer, but it's this funny mixture for me, of practical experience of working in the theatre combined with a historical perspective, both of the 17th century, 16th and 17th century, but also of the changes in attitude and the changes in notions of class that have happened since.
So would you say it's fair to say then that rather than Shakespeare himself being a snob, we're the snobs, we're snobbish in how we view him and his work?
Perhaps. I think that there are a number of things which have obscured our vision, if you like. One of which is a narrow Marxist view. And obviously some of the Marxists are important in this book, but a narrow Marxist view, which is that if his figures are not the heroes of the revolution, then Shakespeare is obviously being contemptuous of them. And I want to say, well, hang on, if you look at history, many times in the past, you know, working people have, you know, sometimes heroes of the revolution, sometimes very worried about revolution, sometimes reactionary, sometimes concerned about change, sometimes embracing change. So I think that that's one perspective which I think has limited our understanding. What I prefer to see with Shakespeare in that particular era is that he's a realist. So when it comes to working people's concerns about the conditions of their lives, there's a wonderful mixture of opinions. Some people looking forward to a better world, a dream of a better world in the future. Some people looking back to what they thought was a better world in the past, a golden age in the past, and yet people living in the present, dealing with those sorts of contradictions. And it seems to me that that's, you know, that's what you see right now in the Brexit debate. You know, some people thinking, well, it could be so much better because it was so much better. You know, it's this brilliant thing about Shakespeare that it hasn't got the judgmentalism that we one way or another bring to the party. There's another interesting area, I think, about which is a confusion, which strangely is evident in one word, which is the word idiot. But the word idiot to the Elizabethans and Jacobeans meant a person of no social of limited social standing. And so somebody said, everybody, except for a tiny number, would have been regarded as idiots because they didn't have social standing. But because of what then happened in attitude to intelligence and intellectual ability, this kind of weird confusion emerged, or change, if you like, which said that that Shakespeare, when he says a tale told by an idiot, or when people are referred to as clowns, they're obviously intellectually very limited. They've got learning disabilities. But they don't. What he's talking about is a class difference, not an intellectual difference. Now, of course, there's a difference in learning, and that's evident. But it's not a difference in somehow innate ability, if you like, innate. It's not innate. And if anything, what Shakespeare does is he sort of deconstructs power and class. He shows, for example, I mean, brilliantly, he always shows that the king is just a man who's going to die and, you know, is subject to all the usual things that all human beings are subject to. So that what Shakespeare's doing all the time is he's sort of deconstructing class. He's unpacking it. But he is obsessed and fascinated by class distinction. So that brings me on to a sort of related issue that's happened, I think, in the theatre, but in culture, which says we're all middle class now, which, of course, is a lie. But that what then happens is that then Hamlet becomes just a middle class bloke living in Tufnell Park. And then you forget that he's a prince. Then you forget that he has power. Then you forget the particular nature of his education, the particular nature of his opinions. But actually what I think Shakespeare's writing is he's saying this is these are the structures of power. And he's laying them open on this open stage. And I think that's a very important insight, very important thing to bear in mind. What's happening there? What do I mean by that? In the modern theatre, with electric light, you put a light on the person who speaks the most, and other people are semi in the dark. The audience are told who to look at. I'm caricaturing that a bit, but I think you understand what I mean. Whereas in the Elizabethan theatre, there is no electric light. There is no, you have to look at this. So everybody who appears on stage is actually of equal interest, of equal humanity, of equal three-dimensionality. They're just like, oh, that person's interesting, that person's interesting. So that the very act of putting them on a stage, on an open stage like the Globe was, does two things. Is it deconstructs the powerful and it elevates the powerless. It gives the powerless a voice. They're given a chance to express their views. And the powerful actually have to rub shoulders with the powerless in a kind of wonderful sort of democratizing way. And I'm not, democracy is perhaps the wrong word, but in a sort of strange process of egalitarianism. Going back to history, if you put Shakespeare, which I think you should, between the great theological, psychological, emotional crisis of the Reformation in the 1530s, and the dissolution of the monasteries and all of those huge changes, if you put it standing between that and the Civil War of the 1640s, with the great sort of, well, again, theological, but also political, social drama of that. And so there's this playwright standing between these two great moments, the sort of the two most significant moments in British history, in my mind, or anyway, whatever, but hugely important. And that everything changed in those two great crises. In fact, you could say they're all part of the same crisis. But those are crises about how people live together, what the duties we have to each other, what the structures of society are. You know, they include the execution of the king, you know, 100 years before the French. More than 100 years before the French. There he is writing in a cleverer people than me have called, you know, a changing, restless world. And I think that's absolutely right, that it is a changing, restless world. And that he's writing plays which are full of who's going to own the future? Whose future is it? Who's going to own the past? Whose version of the past matters? What are the values that connect a society? What are the things that tear a society apart? And these guys and girls, and there are huge numbers of them, have an incredibly important role to play. Incredibly important role to play. And then in a funny kind of way, if you turn your back on them or ignore them, the plays shrink. They're so small. But when you look at them and have them in there, that you see what a vast, realistic panorama of life it is, because it understands social class.
And was Shakespeare unique in this at the time then? Were other playwrights really engaging with all social classes?
Some of the other playwrights were, some of them weren't. There's a guy called Thomas Hayward who wrote what were called citizen plays, and those did try to engage with social class Of course, they all engage with social class. You can't really write about England without engaging with social class. I think what Shakespeare does is he brings this strangely tender, humane three-dimensionality to his figures. But just going back to perceptions and how we look at this stuff, there's been a very interesting thing is that the last 30, 40 years, Shakespeare studies, for understandable reasons, have been absolutely dominated by questions about gender, sexuality, religion sometimes, but actually this kind of very primary thing about class has been neglected.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Shop Tommy John's Friends and Family Sale right now and get 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some for my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
That's really interesting that you say that the questions of gender, sexuality and class have been separated in this way because they're so interrelated. I mean, you discuss gender in your book. There's a chapter devoted to working women. And this is something I found really interesting is Shakespeare's portrayal of working women and how some people say that he's a sexist. Can you expand a bit more on that for us?
So in a way, the portrayal of the women is one of the most complicated things. It has to be understood that the women were played by boys or men. So inevitably, straight away, there is a level of grotesque. Well, not grotesque, but distant. You know, it's got this peculiar, this particular twist. But what I think Shakespeare does with the women is, like all of his characters, he's a realist. He's writing about people trying to make a living. There's a fascinating thing, I think, about his portrayal of, sorry to say this, but, you know, you asked me about women in general, but, you know, it's an element in it, his portrayal of sex workers. He's completely not prurient. He's not interested in it in a kind of sexual way. He's interested in it as the degradation and how do these people trying to make a living? So there's all the time this kind of interest in ordinariness, interest in kind of, and that these figures, whether it's the women or all of them actually, provide a kind of real world ballast against which the aspirations of the aristocracy and the monarchy look sort of, yeah, fine, but it provides a kind of skepticism. It provides a kind of materialism and a kind of, and frankly, you know, as I think we all know from history, the moment that the leader loses touch with everyday realities is the moment that they start being terrible leaders.
Okay, so you've mentioned a lot that Shakespeare is this realist. He's creating complex three-dimensional characters. So is it fair to say then that they are a really true depiction of what it would be like to be an Elizabethan worker? Or are there times when he does slip into stereotypes and he's not faithfully reflecting reality?
Look, I think what he's doing is that the plays are like genre paintings. So there'll be a shepherd, and the shepherd will have a version of the classical shepherd in him, okay, from Theocritus or Virgil or whatever. But then Shakespeare will surprise us by little realistic touches, which make him more tangible and contemporary than you would think. But in a way, that's what he's doing with the aristocrats as well. You know, Hamlet is the revenge hero, which is the stereotype, who then is not very good at doing revenge. Do you see what I mean? But you have to, the audience knows both. So there are, of course, these endless layers of culture. It's not modern naturalistic writing, but it is what's called, I would call, realistic writing, and that's a difference. There is always these touches which make us understand the kind of how the person earns a living, what that takes, what that imposes on the person. While at the same time, it's not quite stereotype, isn't quite the right word. As I say, genre, I think, is a better way of putting it. There are a series of prototypes underneath it, okay? So there's the Bible. The Bible, you know, as a work of literature, which is what I see it as, is extraordinary, the number of working people who are in the Bible, you know, particularly the New Testament, endlessly that. Christianity at its heart has this religion of, is a religion of poverty. I mean, gone, corrupted and all sorts of things. So that's prototype one. Then there's prototype two, which is the Roman, the classical world, which of course has its workers, its poor people, its breadth of vision. Then there's the English folk tradition, which Shakespeare is drawing on, which, you know, which is the people in the woods, the spirits, but that's again, it's a perspective of a lower class perspective. And then I suppose the fourth prototype is the English history, the Hundred Years' War, the chronicles of soldiers, sailors, people fighting the French, that again has got a breadth of vision, an inclusive social vision, which isn't just about the ruling elite. So he draws on all of those literary and cultural received figures, if you like. But all the time, it just provides that little bit of spice, little bit of detail, little bit of flavour, by which they kind of spring to immediate life. But it's not just that these figures are just like you would have seen on the streets all the time. It's both, because it's very sophisticated art, of course.
And thinking about that spice that you mentioned, could we say that comes from his own personal experience? Because this is something that you touched on earlier in the conversation that I wanted to return to, how his experience of working people, particularly his experience of rural England, how does that colour his plays and his work?
Well, of course, all we have is the plays. We don't know what he thought. But it's impossible to imagine the young playwright from Stratford-upon-Avon ignorant or entirely blind to what is going on all around him all the time, everywhere he looks. You've got this society in extraordinary change. You've got poor people tramping the roads. You've got beggars. You've got craftsmen everywhere you look. So the aristocracy and the nobility and the gentry and royalty, of course, is a tiny proportion of society. The vast majority are working people of one kind or another. So, you know, that's everywhere. So he can't not have noticed that. But then what I think is interesting is that then this great public art form, the theatre is a great public art form, so it's not poetry. It's not closeted poetry. It's not painting miniatures. It's the great public art form. To theatres where they think at their very height, 3,000 people would come to a performance. It's an enormous number in a city which is bursting apart at the seams. Increasingly, the social issues that we know happen in big cities. You know, and the theatre is sort of standing in the middle of that. Well, I mean, it's on the South Bank, but it's, to all intents and purposes, it's the kind of fulcrum of the social energies all over the place. And they, my point is that they walk across the stage, across this big platform stage. There's an interesting thing, which is rebellion, which does happen. And there's a character called Jack Cade, who's an extraordinary figure in one of the very early plays, Henry VI, Part Two. And Jack Cade is this, sometimes people say Jack Cade was written for Shakespeare to show that working people should never rebel. He's a popular rebel. But what Shakespeare does instead, and the guy appears in about six or seven scenes in the play, so it's a big, big story arc, is what Shakespeare does is he shows both why Jack Cade has a grievance and why the people who support him have a grievance. And rebellion was incredibly common. Then he shows how what Jack Cade is facing is absolutely violent suppression from the ruling class, right? And then Shakespeare shows that he, in response, will use violence. You know, he's both a rabble rouser, but he's a rabble who's got a cause to be roused. And then Shakespeare does this brilliant thing right at the end, at his death. He makes us care about him, makes us feel for him, and you realize that this charismatic figure is now wandering through the countryside. His rebellion has been defeated. He's wandering through the countryside, starving to death. And he tries to beg a little bit of something to eat, you know, and he ends up and he gets killed. So what I'm trying to say is that the way we should look at the past is look at it in contradictory terms, and that Shakespeare is doing exactly the same thing. So what I'm trying to say is that in the same way that we need to look at our, you know, more modern history dialectically, contradictorily, and say both and. So Shakespeare's doing that about these characters, and actually about all his characters. He's saying they are both have a very good cause to be fed up, and that there is there's a charismatic energy. It's not surprising that he gets people to follow him, and yet at the same time, working people know that a time of disruption can be really bad for them.
I couldn't end this interview without asking about your title, Poor Naked Wretches. And over the course of our conversation, listeners might think that perhaps that's a bizarre title because we've talked about the complexity, the realism. Why did you choose Poor Naked Wretches?
Well, Poor Naked Wretches, it's called Poor Naked Wretches, Shakespeare's Working People. There's a very, very great moment in King Lear when Lear prays to his subjects, his imaginary subjects, and he realizes that he has done nothing for them. And he says, and I'm going to read it, it's five lines. Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm, how shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these? Well, there we go. There's Shakespeare, our contemporary, with the when we're all having to pay through the nose for electricity and gas. So that what there is at the heart of this, it's not quite pity, it's empathy in the writing. And that Lear, who's never thought about the poor in his sub-kingdom before, sort of coming to a realisation. I mean, he says, I've taken too little care of this. He hasn't noticed it.
That was Stephen Unwin. His book, Poor Naked Wretches, is published by Reaction Books and is out now. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.